Okay, today I want to talk a little more about how we use isotopes to determine source spidergram, and then I'm going to expose you to the mantle zoo. That will become obvious what that means. We'll talk a little about whether the various species in the mantle zoo, which have different heat production, whether that can actually affect, well, to what extent thermal heterogeneity in the mantle can result from compositional heterogeneity as evidenced from isotopes. Probably I wanted to talk a little more about helium, but my guess is we're not probably going to quite make that. Now, first thing, I have to make a correction to something I gave you back in the melting equations. I gave you an equation for talked about melting, batch melting, fractional melting, and I gave you an equation for modal aggregated fractional melts, and thanks to Jasper, it turns out that the equation I gave you was for modal instantaneous fractional melts, and I'm sure you've all coded that in and realized that that was wrong. Anyway, the correct equation. Jasper to tell me what's right. The one we had before had a D here, I believe, and just a 1 minus F, 1 over D minus 1. Anyway, this is the right. The graph that I drew for you has the right, was done with the right stuff. Okay. So let's just review quickly the way isotopes evolve as a lead-in to the mantle zoo. Remember, we have some initial ratio, and we talked about how we know that. And bulk Earth, we believe, is a strontium number like 7047, but not at all well constrained. Technically, one of the ways you can trace this evolution line is to go back in the rock record. For example, there are lots of rocks 3.8 billion years old, and technically we could go to those rocks, measure this initial strontium isotope ratio, and actually put a point there and see if this is really the way bulk Earth works. There are a number of problems. One is, even today, in the best of circumstances, when we measure an isotope on a heterogeneous mantle domain, we really don't know what that domain is. We give it names, and it's part of the mantle zoo. But back in time, it's really, really hard to know what the sample that you're looking at, what it belongs to, where it came from, you know, what sort of a tectonic setting it is. Worse than that, because it's 3.8 billion years old, it's usually been through at least one major metamorphic tectonic event, which basically screws up the isotopes. So, particularly for strontium, it's incredibly hard, and there are virtually no numbers. Is at 2.8. There are a couple of values that I trust, which don't actually really help much in defining this line. Anyway, so it's hard to go back in time and figure out what's going on. We talked about two-stage models. What we're trying to model is stuff like this. There's certain one of the species in the mantle zoo has very high strontium, and we'd like to know how it got there. The other more common species, which is the depleted upper mantle, as you've seen in the tutorial, sort of averages around 7026. That's the depleted upper mantle. We'd like to know how we got from here to there, and we don't really know that. I showed you two-stage models, continuous models, and so forth. But let's just for a minute take the simplest model, make a two-stage model, say starting at 3. Okay, we don't really know if it's a two-stage model if it started at 3. But if we use the same model and the same age for all the isotope systems, at least then they'll all be consistent internally. Okay, and I'll show you where we're going with this. So we're going to do this. You remember the slope on this diagram is the rubidium-strontium ratio, the parent-daughter ratio. And just for this particular model, 3 billion years from bulk Earth to there, there, and there, we have these values. Okay, so you can see there's basically a factor of 10 difference in the parent-daughter ratio to evolve into the upper mantle as opposed to evolving to this radiogenic species in the mantle zoo. Okay, so what we'd really like to know, what we're trying to see back through, is to identify the composition of the mantle source that these guys represent. Okay. So from strontium, we get information on that. And we have all these other systems. Okay, we have samarium neodymium, we have uranium lead, we have thorium lead, we have lutetium hafnium, we have rhenium osmium. So you can see we can do exactly the same modeling, picking the same age, okay, and determine all of these parent-daughter ratios. Now, if we change the age, clearly we're going to change all of these, but we change them all sort of in proportion. And as long as we use the same age for all of these, we get an internally consistent set of parent-daughter ratios. So we go back to this spidergram, and now I'm just going to put a few elements on here. Going to put the elements on based on the radiogenic decay systems that we can constrain. So let's start with this. And now we're not going to do, we could in principle do pieces of a spidergram for each of these domains, okay? I'll show you in a minute when we talk about the mantle zoo that all of these isotope systems are coherent in any one of these sort of n-member mantle species. Okay, so we can pick, for example, let's pick the upper mantle since that's the best studied and the best understood. If we look at all of these decay systems for the upper mantle, we get all of these parent-daughter ratios, and we can then plot them on here, okay? Well, rubidium, and plot them relative to bulk Earth. Remember, bulk Earth is like this. If we normalize all the concentrations to bulk Earth, Now, we don't know the absolute numbers. I showed you two lectures ago how we can use abyssal peridotites to get absolute concentrations of the elements that you can measure in abyssal peridotites. Unfortunately, the only elements you can actually measure in abyssal peridotites are those two guys. Okay. The rest of them are all either so low in concentration you can't measure them, or they've been screwed up. So that's why it's helpful to have this parent-daughter constraint. Okay, so what we know then is that, and I'm going to let these float in space. I'm just going to make this up. All right, this is a made-up spidergram. But we can adjust it up and down. The basic sense of the spidergram will remain true. So why did I draw it like this? Well, I drew it like that because the rubidium-strontium ratio of the upper mantle is 5 times lower than bulk Earth. So we just put on here a slope, which is, again, the rubidium-strontium ratio, okay, relative to bulk Earth. And I could do that exactly. But so, and then you just work your way through this whole system, doing a model for each isotope system, getting a parent-daughter ratio, and plotting it on here. And again, each system will float in this space because we don't know the absolute concentrations. So I'm going to plot a bunch of these connecting lines, but I'm going to plot them in such a way that they're smooth. Okay. For example, the next one, uranium-lead, I could plot it up here. I'm going to plot it where it makes more sense. So we go uranium, lead. Unfortunately, uranium, lead in the upper mantle, from what we know back through the isotopes, is greater than bulk Earth. Okay. So we have a little, better do that right. Thorium lead, the same deal. Lutetium hafnium is greater than bulk Earth. Samarium neodymium is greater than bulk Earth. So you can see we've made a bunch of pieces. We don't know where they are, whether they actually, but we presume they're going to connect up and be smooth. So you can sort of adjust them to be smooth, and you end up making a spidergram for more. I'm not sure it's going to somewhat fanciful. Okay, you can adjust all that so it looks better. But you realize, okay, there's an age built into this, which will largely just translate this guy up and down and steepen it or flatten it. And there's the fact that none of these are connected, so we have to make up the connection based on our understanding of the way trace elements partition. So we could do the same thing for this guy, for this species, and again, I'm just going to something like that. Okay. But you realize we only have kind of pieces of it. They're fairly strong constraints relative to each other. But again, they tend to float in space. We could anchor the DMM, the upper mantle one, by virtue of the fact that the abyssal peridotite data gives us absolute values. So these two guys we can fix in the spidergram space and then attach everything else. Okay. So all of that sounds a little iffy, and it is, but we can certainly tell the difference between a shape that looks like this and a shape that looks like that. So one thing the isotope geochemists are incredibly good at measuring isotopes. I mean, we do that to part in 10 to the fifth, okay? So it's kind of scary, because when I show you the isotope diagram for the mantle zoo, it looks incredibly variable. But you need to ask, what does that actually mean in terms of parent-daughter ratios? How much do we have to fiddle with the spidergram to make this huge range of isotopes? Well, not very much, it turns out. And just for this model here, the difference between this line and this line, which are in fact the two limits for the mantle zoo in strontium. Okay, this is the highest species, this is the lowest. Okay, that factor of 10 in rubidium strontium ratio. Okay, so that sounds like a major fractionation. But when you look at the same thing for samarium neodymium, 25%. In other words, all you have to do is fiddle bulk earth samarium neodymium up and down, so the total range in this ratio is 25%. You can generate the whole range in neodymium isotopes. Well, this is really pretty small potatoes. I mean, when you look at the partitioning data, what you have to do to achieve that isn't very much. So we're already seeing that we're probably diverging or not converging with what geophysics can tell us, because you guys, the geophysicists, to see anything, you're dealing with really major compositional variations, in my opinion. Isotope guys see these huge variations in isotopes, but they're actually based on pretty trivial variations in mantle source. This is about a factor of two. I haven't even worked out the rest, but they're not large variations that are required.
Can I be dumb for a second?
Sure.
So you're saying that the parent-daughter ratio is like 25%, or
no, just to make a model that goes from here to the maximum extremes in, let's say, 3 billion years, we don't know, only takes a 25% total variation. In other words, the samarium neodymium of the upper mantle needs only be 25% larger than the samarium neodymium of this extreme species to give us what we see in the isotopes. So in a sense, the isotope guys are really too good at their measurements, but we lack seriously in conceptual understanding of this. Okay, so we're going to look at some modern visual aids. I break my pedagogical philosophy by doing this, but now some of you have sort of heard the acronyms that go with the mantle zoo. This is just, we'll broaden this to isotope multispace, but we'll start simple with just one against the other, okay? And this is just strontium against lead. And it really doesn't matter. You don't have to worry about the numbers and what they mean, okay? It's just a fingerprint diagram, sort of looking like at mantle DNA. So it arranges itself, and it may not be obvious, but there's a large variation in strontium, which I just told you about, going from morb down here to the highest, which we call EM2. That's just enriched mantle 2. And that's because there are two different kinds of enriched mantle, and we just said one of them is enriched mantle 1, enriched mantle 2. Over here, there's a thing called high mu, based on the fact that its signature is this very high 206-204 lead, which must come from a aging in a high uranium lead system. You remember the general isotope evolution equation I gave you, the parent-daughter, is typically called mu. Okay. So hence comes the acronym high mu. And then Morb is over here. And then every island is, it's a very organized zoo. Okay. The species don't sort of randomly live here and there, but they organize themselves into little cages. So, for example, well, take what you like. The end member high mu is from Mangaia, which is in the Cook Australs. And every sample you take on the island of Mangaia plots in this little teeny field. Okay. So it's not like you go to an island and you get some of this and some of that and so forth. They tend, as you can see, and there are hundreds of these fields. I mean, I haven't shown even remotely the whole data set. Ocean ridges, as you've worked in the tutorial, occupies a completely restricted field. Okay, and it's, I mean, it's identifiable immediately when you go walk into the zoo, if you have your strontium and lead meter with you. Okay, there's no overlap between this and any of this other stuff. There's some mixing occasionally. The two cages get too close together and these guys jump back and forth. So for example, in Iceland, which is, I don't know where it is here, somewhere here, the ridge adjacent to Iceland will have some contamination from the Iceland species. Samoa, you know, as I say, this is end member. Okay, how do these things organize around the world? Species from high mu, we find them in Mangaia, we find them in Tuvoi, which is another Cook island in the Cook Australs. So those both come from the same hot spot. But we can also go into the Atlantic and look at St. Helena, that island, that hot spot, and it also is high mu. So it's not as if we only have one example of each of these species. Okay, this is the holotype, but there are other places in the world where this species shows up. EM2, the most enriched example of EM2 is Samoa, but you also find it in Tahiti and the societies. So that's a slightly different part of the Pacific. Less so in the Atlantic. I guess there's not another really, really good example of extreme EM2 in the world. EM1, the holotype is Pitcairn, which is also in the Pacific, north of the societies. But there are other examples of it. In the Atlantic, the Walvis Ridge, which is the hotspot chain coming off Tristan and Gough, has very extreme EM1. You go into the Indian Ocean, there's a little island called Christmas Island that's about to head into that subduction zone, which escapes me. Anyway, that shows up. So that shows up in all three oceans. So the only point is these things exist. There's not just one example. There are examples in different parts of the world, which, you know, makes you feel like they mean something. There was, for many years, lots of argument about whether there were such things as kind of end-member boxes of mantle, or whether this was all just the result of random parent-daughter perturbations that occasionally lead you into extreme space. Pardon? You mean, do I have one? Well, there's certainly maps of all the hotspots. And I guess if you... I'll show you. This is part of... I'll organize this into geography in a little bit. But. Okay, bulk Earth, all right, would be on about 17.5. Chondrites themselves, of course, have this huge rubidium strontium ratio, so they would be up on the third floor because the Earth, you know, didn't get its full complement of rubidium. So they're, for rubidium strontium, they're a lousy guide to bulk Earth, but for lead, they're an extremely good guide, and it would be here. Right. All we know is that, well, they actually, they fill this whole region because there are a variety of chondrites with different uranium-lead ratios. But the bulk Earth, starting with R0 for lead and just letting it age for 4.534 billion years, okay, means you will end up around here for a terrestrial system. No, Luigi, okay, is this the new the active end of the Hawaiian hotspot chain, the little seamount sitting on the side of Kilauea, and it has the highest, one of the highest helium in the world, and most of the Big Island, okay, falls in this general region. But as you go downstream, there's on Oahu, there's a shield volcano named called Kulau, which in fact trends up. So there is a trend in Hawaii up this way toward EM1, and it gets pretty close. I mean, the extreme Kulau gets very close to Pitcairn. Yeah. Oh, that's a very good question. If you find the answer to that question, you'll be famous. It's called the lead paradox. As I said before, we know the bulk Earth has to be on that, what we call a geochron in lead-lead space. Absolutely, I don't see any way to avoid that. And almost everything we measure, certainly in the oceans, lies to the right of that geochron. The surface continental crust lies to the right of the geochron. So, good question. Where is all the rest of the stuff that has to balance it? And people say, well, the lower crust has been depleted in uranium, so it will be less radiogenic and may plot over here someplace. But despite great efforts to make a significant lead budget come out of the lower crust, the continental crust, it really doesn't work. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, this has been a lead paradox has existed for 30 years. And
one of the other explanations is worth mentioning, and that is that there's continuing interaction with the core, and that we've been losing lead along the way, right?
That's right.
So if you're interested in what's happening in the core mantle, could you demonstrate that the lead was so, that lead was getting sucked out of the mantle by the core, not because of lead sewer pile, but of the
but it would have to happen post core formation. I mean, it's quite likely that some complement of the Earth's lead is in the core, and that's the reason the Earth has a high uranium lead ratio. But you have to, whatever you did initially isn't going to move you off the geochron. You'd have to do it over time. And I mean that was one possible escape from the lead paradox. Personally, doesn't matter what I think. I mean, we're still looking for the smoking gun for interaction between plumes and the core. And for years, people have thought this was something important. And for a while, the osmium 186, which I talked about a little bit, was proposed as evidence for this interaction. There was the, as I also mentioned, the tungsten thing, where kimberlites were found to have funny tungsten, and that was evidence for core interaction, but that blew up because it was bad data. So I don't think there's any compelling evidence right now, smoking gun, that says we have interaction. Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of, it would be a good problem for the dynamicist to, if you put little bits of metal alloy in the mantle, you know, sort of residual from core formation, how long can they survive before they just sink out? And I mean, Dave Stevenson looked at that many years ago and said, once it's a catastrophic process, especially if you have a magma ocean early on, you just strip it all out. But we may, you know, I end up being very unfixed on almost anything. Somebody says, do you absolutely know anything? I say, well, no. Okay, just to expand a little bit, that last plot was just two isotopes. Now we look at three, and it's in a normal coordinate system up there, strontium, neodymium, and lead, so we've added neodymium. And so in three space, in three-dimensional space, these N members, which we defined first on strontium and neodymium, also have our N members in neodymium space. And then in three space, what you do is have a tetrahedron. Okay, you know what a tetrahedron is, just four triangles put together. And it's floating in, it's not aligned with any of the three principal axes. Okay, it's oriented in a funny way, floating in this three space. So upper mantle, high mu, EM1, EM2. Okay, those are our four mantle end members. And this just shows you another collection of islands to show you that, again, islands group. They don't just sort of splatter all over this diagram. And they even, once we look in three space, they group into these things that, these arrays that look like worms. So the question is, well, why, and they look like mixing arrays. They may be evolutionary arrays, but nobody's ever tackled that problem. You think of them as mixing arrays between some of these end members and something else. The most obvious thing is if a plume comes up from through the upper mantle, it will entrain upper mantle in it. It's inescapable. If you then can, if you sample it in such a way that some of your melt comes from the upper mantle that was entrained, then a lot of these you might think mix toward DMM, the upper mantle. But in fact, many of these arrays, none of them point toward the upper mantle. They point instead toward this thing which we call FOZO, which is an acronym built from focus zone. And nobody in the whole world except me likes that word, but and I'm noted for making up acronyms. That, yes. Yeah, so this includes everything except the post-erosional stuff, which is in fact over here. So Louise Kulau's up there, Louis is down in there.
Do we have enough resolution on the measurements as a function of weight? Can you trace the time evolution in the particular island chain? That might give you some constraints on evolutionary history that you might reproduce.
Yeah, it's generally messy. In Hawaii, for example, just take strontium. The big island's sort of all the same. I mean, Don would see many second order obvious characterizations in the big island, but it's sort of the same. And it goes like that all the way down the chain till you get to Kulau on Oahu and Kuhulawe, some of the little Lanai, some of the little islands south of Oahu, where you get this incredible spike in strontium. It jumps from 7038 to 7045. And then it goes back down again, disappears, and you truck along the chain at about the Big Island value, around the bend, on up the Emperors, and it's pretty constant. And sort of goes down slowly but jumpy until you get to the very end of the emperor chain, when it drops pretty sharply toward kind of more values. I don't think there is any evidence further back the chain for this really enriched stuff. So it's like you've had a pretty constant bloom with one bunch of enriched stuff that came up a few million years ago. Is that?
Yeah, that's a good description. I would just add that the enriched stuff that goes up toward EM1, you do see it on the Big Island. You see it in the lavas that have come out of Mauna Loa in the last 20,000 years.
Yeah. But only as a very small, I mean, it gets you about 10% of the way toward the extreme Koolau, is my guess.
I think the 87-86 ratio is about 704.
Okay, so maybe so 25% of the way.
Halfway there, yeah. And it goes down well. But then it turns out that in Koolau, with the drill core that they've done there, that,
yeah, that the it's,
Koolau signature is
right,
on the
top.
Yeah. Volcano, you drill it, so even that looks like it was a short-lived.
Yeah. I mean, the plume people, this plume person, would say, well, the plume has some heterogeneity internal to it, and that there was one blob of enriched stuff that came up under Oahu and melted and went away, and we haven't seen another one. Except all of Hawaii, as Don points out, seems to have a little bit of this Koolau component,
comes
sort of.
Mm-hmm. We have to have an explanation for where it's coming from and why it comes from. One question that I have for you, maybe you're going to get to it. This diagram deals with four isotopes, but doesn't deal with helium.
Right.
Does it cover helium?
Well, I was going to talk about that a little bit to make the point that, I mean, when this first, the evolution in isotope space has been in 1978, when Don started neodymium work. We had strontium and neodymium, very little lead data. But it looked like you could sort of explain all the isotope data with two boxes, upper mantle and everything else. And then gradually we got to refine that, looked at it in better resolution, turned into three boxes, which then defined a mantle plane in three space. Okay, and then we got a little better at it, and it looked like the mantle plane turned into a tetrahedron. And people kept telling me that every time we invent a new isotope system or start a new isotope system, we add a new end member, so that this tetrahedron next year might become a five vertices polyhedron. But in fact, it hasn't happened. Since this was done in 1986, we've added rhenium, osmium, we've added lutetium, hafnium, and these end members, as defined originally from just strontium and lead, are still the same end members. In other words, if you go to Mangaia, well, let's take EM2 as a better example. You go to Samoa and look at lutetium hafnium. The hafnium isotopes will be an end member in hafnium space. And so we basically, every new system has only confirmed that it looks like four end members. Now, Don said, well, what about helium? And helium is a really big problem because we know what helium in the upper mantle is. It's 8. Ra plus or minus 1. I mean, it's incredibly constant. You go do helium on Haimu Islands, it's 7. 7, 7. 6.5, 7.5, okay? You do it on EM1, it's like 11, 11, 11. Do it on Samoa, you do it on that end of Samoa, it's about 9. Okay? But, so none of the end members have high helium. They're all sort of Morb-like, upper mantle-like. But we know that Iceland goes up to 43 Ra. Lu'i goes up to 35 Ra. The Galapagos goes up to 26 Ra. Some of this end of Samoa goes up to about 25 Ra. So in fact, if you just, on this diagram, in this tetrahedron, if you were to plot where all the highest helium samples lie, they all lie in this region. So we proposed that there is in fact a fifth member internal to the tetrahedron. Okay, there's no reason that an end member has to be outside the tetrahedron. That this is the high helium reservoir. And because these things are not pointing toward the upper mantle, we needed a way to mix this material into all of these plumes. So we proposed that the lower mantle is in fact bozo and is the high helium, and that as plumes come up through it, they entrain this material and blah, blah, blah. You get mixing and you get high helium and so forth.
So now people also talk about C and bozo together.
Well, I invented fozo, and then 2 years later, Hayden and Graham came along and worked from the upper mantle end. They looked at the isotope arrays in the upper mantle, and it turns out that if you break this field down, there are also little arrays within the upper mantle, and they point towards something which is a common end member. So Hayden and Graham called that common, which was C. Well, it turns out it's the same thing. They're just going from the Morb end, I'm going from the OIB end. We don't know exactly where either of these are, okay? They're somewhere here. Yep, absolutely. For one thing, in isotope multispace like this, mixing for example, strontium and neodymium isotopes can be very markedly curved depending on the strontium-neodymium ratio of the two ends. If it turns out to be straight, the inference is the strontium-neodymium ratio in the two mixing end members is the same. If they're different, then you end up with curved arrays. And, you know, these arrays aren't that great, let's face it, but to first order, it looks like all of the relative parent-daughter concentrations are the same. Doesn't mean the absolute values are the same, it just means that strontium, it means the spidergrams are the same, though they may be different in height, different in position on the spidergram. It's a key thing, and we may be able to actually back out some more information on these mantle compositions by careful looking at these arrays. The problem is, I think there is beginning to be some experimental uncertainty. You know, the measurement error is kind of built into this scatter, and there are lots of things that make isotopes scatter. So, good question. Yeah, I'll show you exactly that in a, well, I'll show you that now. Yeah.
Can I look at this, is this a qualitative diagram or is this a is it an extension of the ternary?
Well, this is absolutely based on real isotope data.
Okay.
In three space, I mean,
so
I could put...
structure of this quad, the tetrahedron.
Oh. You mean like this, for example? Yeah, okay. What's the process of identifying an end member on here? Fundamentally, you move the end member until everything lies inside the tetrahedron. I mean, that's kind of stupid, right? I can make this tetrahedron big enough to encompass every sample that's ever been measured. But we prefer to actually identify the extreme sample from a given species and use that. And this dimension going this way is 206-204 lead. So the highest 206-204 lead anywhere in the oceans is there. Well, it turns out that there are some samples that have slightly low neodymium, so they don't actually fall. But they're beginning to be, on just the precision of the measurements, beginning to play a role here. We recently moved this EM2, that the position of that vertice in the tetrahedron was at a strontium value of 7077. And 2 years ago, we moved it to 7089 because we found a more extreme, you know, you can always think that you're going to find a more extreme example.
You said that C and FOSA are basically the same thing, but C, as you said, and maybe I misunderstood, sort of originated from looking at the depleted mantle stuff. So it should be a difference because that's upper mantle and FOSA is in lower mantle.
I have no idea. That's a good point. C was defined by the intersection of a lot of these upper mantle arrays pointing towards something. So I guess I would have to say if FOSO or C is lower mantle, it somehow represented material that was mixed into the upper mantle. That may be a stretch. Yeah.
Is there a way that you could get the stuff on the edges by starting from something in the middle and...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, clear. For example, if we were to plot bulk earth on here, which I haven't done because we don't have any samples of it, but it will be up here somewhere. It won't actually lie in the tetrahedron. But since everything came from bulk earth, okay, evolutionary... The isotope evolution diagrams I showed you started 4.5 billion years with bulk earth, and then we did a bunch of stuff to, well, so clearly you can grow any of these end members from bulk earth. So there must be the ability to have an evolutionary system that transitions from bulk earth to these end members. Yeah. There are two schools of thought. I'm a big mixer, okay? So I just like mixing stuff because the equations are really simple and, you know, looks like mixing. But there are other people who say, no, these arrays aren't actually mixing. They're evolution of slightly different reservoirs. You know, for example, if you make a heterogeneous reservoir by taking a little partial melt out of it so that you vary the samarium neodymium ratio. But you don't do it homogeneously, you do it heterogeneously in this box, and then let the box as a whole evolve. Each of these sub-reservoirs will evolve in a slightly different way. And you can easily contrive that to end up with what looks like an array in 3-isotope space or 5-isotope space. To me, that's in a sense, it's then early mixing. In other words, you make the heterogeneities early on, let them grow, and they give you an array. You can do the same thing by taking the two end members of the heterogeneity, this box, letting them grow separately and then mixing them. I mean, it's you get the same answer, and it's just a question of when you produce the heterogeneity. Anyway, that's not a great answer, but...
And maybe it'll get
it's a belief.
One of the big questions, especially at the interface between the sort of stuff you've been talking about in geophysics, is the relationship between these geochemically defined end members and sort of spatially distinct pieces of the, of the mantle, right? And what are some of the concerns? I mean, we've already been talking about FOSO's lower mantle and DMM's upper mantle and so on, but Can I be a little more careful than that, or what are the constraints or the relationships?
It's going to sound like geochemists never agree on anything. there is a school of thought, and we call them the mantle vein people. Okay, it's like Jason Phipps Morgan is the extreme example. To me, I mean, this diagram tells you you had to make this heterogeneity a long time ago. That's the only way you can make this isotopic heterogeneity. But it doesn't say anything whatsoever about the scale of these mantle boxes. And the mantle vein people take it to the extreme, and they say the whole mantle, when looked at on, say, 20 kilometer scale, is homogeneous. Every box is like every other box. But on a scale smaller than 10 kilometers, some number, you have all of these heterogeneities floating around in the box. So you have this whole mantle tetrahedron embraced in one 10 kilometer box. And then all you're doing is sampling different parts of it during the melting process. And I don't, you know, physically, I don't think that's impossible at all. I find it heuristically kind of difficult to deal with. And so, and you know, again, it's a belief thing. This, I'm not a firm believer in multiple working hypotheses. I'm a firm believer in having one mindset. but being open about it, okay.
The issue is, how can you advance from this stage?
Yes.
What are the requirements for seeing the mantle the way you want to
see
it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is it that Haimu is?
Yeah.
Okay, so what, let's answer that one. What is Haimu and how did it get
there? We don't know. Okay. Yeah, I mean the standard model, and I mean we can obviously there, you know, we have some ideas. The standard model is that all of these heterogeneities are basically made at the surface and introduced into the mantle by recycling, and it's just the process: spreading ridge, you make depleted lithosphere, you make continental crust, oceanic crust, you put sediment on it, you let all that stuff run down the subduction zone, and then people identify each of the, this is a tetrahedron again, identify high mu with ocean crust. And they do that because when the ocean crust alters in the oceans, it picks up uranium. It just gloms onto uranium. So the uranium lead ratio goes up, and you recycle it into the mantle, let it sit around for 2 billion years, and it looks like high mu. And by the same token, the two enriched things are believed in the standard model to be two different types of sediment. Well, in the end member, EM2, which we in Samoa, we've done an enormous amount of work now, and it basically is not terrigenous sediment. It is not any kind of sediment. Okay, so our new thinking is that EM2 is the bottom side of the depleted lithosphere that's been metasomatized. Okay, that's just another model. I don't think this standard model, it's almost impossible to test it because as this stuff goes down in the subduction zone, there's an enormous amount of process, chemical processing. You dehydrate, devolatilize the slab, partially melt it, you just do an enormous amount of chemistry. So to model the evolution of high mu, we'd like to know, you know, what box are you doing and what's the chemistry look like and how long does it sit in the mantle? Problem is you go through the subduction zone where you can do almost anything you want. So you can make these sediments, they don't go down into the deep mantle as sediments, okay, they don't go down unchanged. But the changes that are imposed on them in the subduction zone are basically free parameters. And I guarantee you I can make any of this mantle zoo out of this by this process. It's really easy. But it's totally ad hoc.
But doesn't that make it useless categorization?
Well, I look at the... My whole life I've started in messy areas and given up on them and go to simpler and simpler areas. And I ended up in the oceans thinking that was the simplest area. And you go to ridges because they seem the simplest of all. And I'm sort of on ridges right now. But I think rather than trying to understand the evolution of these boxes, I'd like to know what some piece of mantle looks like. So in other words, to make the decision of what is the scale length of this heterogeneity as a way of telling us something about the genesis of these reservoirs. So the vein mantle bothers me a lot because it really makes a huge difference as to how you think about the process of getting there, and whether you think the mantle's heterogeneous on 500 kilometer scale or 10 meter scale. I mean, it's, and to me, we have to get better at looking through the melting process. We see the eruptive products, and Don and I both talked about the complexities of the melting operator. We need to understand that better so we can know if you melt a box with small heterogeneities in it, what would the melt look like? And part of this exercise that we've been doing, okay, with PETDB, was designed to maybe learn something about that. Because if you have small scale heterogeneities, you would expect them to show up as variance in the isotope data because melting is slightly variable. So the question is, did it or didn't it? And hopefully we'll hear some more tomorrow about that from you guys. So that's just my philosophy. Let me quickly just answer another, in a sense, answer another question. Forgetting for the moment what the mantle looks like that supplies these guys, okay? My belief is that it's all peridotite and that it's only mildly manipulated peridotite. As I've shown, the parent-daughter things you have to do aren't very dramatic. So you can take a peridotite and basically change the spidogram without changing the density, the P wave, the shear wave velocity, okay, and make all of this tetrahedron. But you might ask, well, okay, so the tetrahedron's defined by basalts. So if you just look at the spidrograms of these basalts, do they give you any information? And I don't want to go in great detail here, okay, but this just shows all the four end members in the tetrahedron. This is the upper mantle. I think we know that now very well. The other three are just the collections of basalts from the extremes of the other three end members, average, so you get an average spidrogram. And there are differences. You can look and find little differences. But the first order thing that hits me is, wow, those look all the same. Okay, so I don't think these three end member mantles are hugely different in their chemistry, particularly in their major element chemistry. I want to very quickly address the heterogeneity issue, and this is a sort of a, there aren't a lot of ways to address it, and the technique that some people have is what Jason Morgan said was proof by inundation. It says you collect a whole bunch of little poorly known things and you put them in a box until the box gets so full of this stuff you believe it. Okay. I'm not going to do that to you. Let's look at the actual geographic position of all these end members. Okay, I showed you, gave you names to them. You know, Cook Australs, Samoa, Pitcairn, and so forth. Well, where are those all? And Don asked that question. Can you plot these on a map? Well, a long time ago, I plotted them on a map. Let's in fact look at the top just so you don't get confused. This is a world map. And all I did was take the strontium isotope data for all of the basalts in all of the oceanic islands that we had available and contoured it. Okay. So these numbers are the last two digits of a four-digit strontium number, okay? 7032, 7038, and so forth. Okay. Well, what you see right away is the extremes in strontium, at least these two, EM1 and EM2, you don't find them just randomly all over the world. You find a little, what is that? I don't know what that is. Anyway, there's Hawaii. There's a little seamount here that sort of violates my contouring. But so the contouring, I just drew this belt, and it got initiated by a paper by Dupre and Allegre, where they showed that there was a isotopic domain in this region, and they just defined it on isotopes. And when I saw their paper and got thinking about it, I realized that you could sort of expand this around the world. And I named it the DuPaul anomaly after the authors. So Dupre, D-U-P, Allegre, A-L-L. And I used that first, Dupe, all. And Claude called me up after a while. He said, you know, people have been telling me that in English that's not a very nice thing to call it. I said, okay, we won't dupe all the people. We'll. So I chopped off an L, and so we have a dupe all anomaly. Anyway. And it defined it as this global belt encircling the Earth with sort of a couple of really, really high hot spots. One of them in this region, one of them here. This is basically the societies in Samoa, a couple floating in the Indian Ocean. This is Tristan Gough and the Walvis Ridge and so forth. This is an old paper, and there's a lot more data. Trust me, it wouldn't change the picture. There are no end-member basalts in Antarctica or the Arctic. In fact, it's a curious fact that there are very few hotspots in polar regions. And in fact, statistically, the hotspots are congregated in toward low latitudes. That's another story. Pardon? This guy? It's the Ahaggar Volcanic Province. I tried to stay away from the continents because they're really, everything gets contaminated. By definition, if you contaminate a basalt by continental material, you make EM1 or EM2. But this was something that Allegre had worked on, and it seemed like a clean thing. But there are good questions. You know, does this cross? Can you see this crossing South America? Can you see this in Australia? People have done work, and yes or no, and so forth. So the point of doing this was just to say, oh, it seems unlikely that you could have this mantle zoo existing in as veins in a little box. Okay, if you think you've got a 10-kilometer box with a whole mantle tetrahedron sitting in it, and all you're doing is sampling it on small scale, then why this? Okay. So my argument was, this to me looks like, I mean, this is a degree 2 anomaly, degree 3, 4. This is a big anomaly. So therefore, the heterogeneities must be big. Well, you realize that's not a quantitative argument, but it's the best I can do.
Well, that was my first
thing. I went to one of my GFD friends. I said, wow, this looks like, you know, rotation thing. And he said, no, forget it, Hart. You can't do that. But in fact, you can do that in the core.
It's extraordinary, actually. I mean, so, okay, the equations of motion for the mantle, you could just as easily turn here from the south, okay, and have the north pole and south pole on the equator, right? You had an anomaly that sort of went through a band like that, blocked you, and say that can't be. It's extraordinary.
Well, you know, and I still carry in my mind, I don't talk about it because people think I'm weird. But that somehow the core, which can have an equatorial, I'm not even sure of that. Can you get...
So now an angle seems to know where you put it.
Right. Well, let me just show you, make one step further. I mean, this, all this gives you some sense that these heterogeneities are really, really large. The mantle vein people will say, no, you can do this. All it means is that, you know, you have a little more veins in a box in the equatorial regions or something. You can wiggle.
But, I mean, you have to think about what this might mean. One thing that it might mean is that, let's say the plumes all come from the bottom of the mantle, either from the dense layer down there or from the core mantle down. So if these are all plumes, these are only mapping the heterogeneity that's at the base of the mantle.
Thank you. Here's my next. And I know I shouldn't be showing the Princeton model here. I'm sorry, wherever Adam is. Oh, he's gone. Phew. Okay. What is obvious, okay, to me anyway, is that the two superplumes, so-called superplumes, the African superplume and the West Pacific superplume, are centered here and here. So two of these really intense parts of the Dupol anomaly correlate with the superplumes. And this is just a map of, this is the Princeton tomography map. And the reason I use it is because they've adjusted their color contours to make these hot spots as small as possible. Okay, and it's part of truth in lending. Anyway, this is the average velocity in the lower 1,000 kilometers of the mantle. And that's the African superplume. It would be larger if you just changed your color contours, but it's focused right there. This is, in a sense, this whole collection of red spots is the Pacific superplume, showed up wrapped around here. Those correlate with these extremes in the isotope taxonomy. Wow. Carolina to the rescue. Where was Siberia? I mean, that would be a really interesting thing to do, is to take this back in time. The problem is you only can deal with continents or continental volcanism because everything else is gone. I firmly stay away from the continents because I don't know how to read through that part of the process. But it would be wonderful. We would love to be able to do that all the way back in time. Siberia is probably right here.
For the last 200 million years,
sure. Oh, 200 million years, they aren't going to. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then, look at the evolution of the pattern.
I mean, I got...
The evolution and the pattern of divergence in the last 84 million years. So it was hemispherical, north-south, and now it's hemispherical.
I got really excited in the early Dupol days by the fact that Australia is moving northeast right now and has been for a long time, 80 million years. So Australia, 80 million years ago, was south of the Dupol Belt. And it's been encroaching on it. It's halfway across it. And it also has a long history of Cenozoic volcanism in the eastern part of Australia. I thought, oh, really simple. Just look at volcanics of different ages and watch to see if you see the Dupol come on. But it's a continental thing. And I tried to get some of the Australians to do it, and they didn't do a very good job. So I don't know the answer to that. But there's some things that could be done. Anyway, I mean, again, this not only makes it isotopically, the Dupol looks like a large-scale anomaly, it correlates, I think, in a way that's not just a random chance, correlates with lower mantle warm areas. So it means that the isotopic tetrahedron, it has an origin in the lower mantle. Again, that's my belief. single-minded. And okay, I think we ought to quit there and have coffee. Thank you.
How do you generate from that thousands of kilometer scale heterogeneity? Don't you have to do that in order to have this large scale structure? You have to aggregate this.
Well,
you have to collect the high use stuff in a particular area.
You could. I mean, the way I think about it, which is just my own way of thinking about it, is that the lower mantle may be littered with recycled material everywhere. So it's not that this is telling us where it is. This is where we're sampling it. We're sampling it because of these two large-scale upwellings that happen to be, for whatever reason, in these areas. And so they're entraining stuff off D double prime and giving us sort of the highest component of that in the volcanism. And that's in part why the hotspots are congregated in the same
Hawaii,
region.
Though, it's not, is it?
No, I know Hawaii's in anybody's book is
so
anomalous.
It's not that you're only sampling it of this particular stuff. You're sampling a lot of different stuff. And you're claiming that heterogeneities generated at small scales are aggregated or in some way into larger scales. So you're clumping things. And I mean, you're clumping something that represents the upper part of the oceanic crust in one place and something that represents the lower part of the oceanic crust in another place.
Mm-hmm. All of that. I mean, there's certainly nothing that illustrates the need for isotope people to interact with dynamicists, mineral physicists, and seismologists. I mean, this is, to me, is the perfect encapsulation of why we're here. And we can't do it. I mean, if I had enough money to just hire my own team of dynamicists, seismologists, and mineral physicists so I could tell them what to do, I have a really specific list of things I'd like. But, you know, I'm stuck. I mean, I know where the roadblocks are in the isotopes. I know what I can do with isotopes. But that's not really where I'm stuck. But I'm stuck in places that I can't do anything about, so I come here. Well, I think the first thing is we talked to Bruce about is to look at what the mantle does in the way of stirring and mixing when you inject the heterogeneity. You know, the old Hoffman and McKenzie diagram, you start with this black square and it ends up in squiggles. Would love to know if you put a 100 kilometer lithosphere plus oceanic crust in to a flow field and let it wiggle around for a billion years, whether any of that remains, whether it's stretched out into meter layers, whether it's completely obliterated. I mean, this kind of, because this is the scale we sample the mantle on. The melting is on, you know, perhaps 10, 20 kilometer scale. And if we don't have any understanding of how injected heterogeneities get stirred over time, because we have to keep this, I mean, I didn't make the point, but this mantle tetrahedron is isotopically variable, and it takes time to make those variations. By the same token, you have to keep them from mixing over that same time scale. So in other words, this, you can easily make heterogeneities 3 billion years ago and have them grow into this mantle tetrahedron. But you've got to keep all these species in the zoo separate from each other. In other words, otherwise they kill each other and you don't end up with anything. So they're, you know,
the problem is done. The fact is they never go away. They just get scared.
I'd like somebody to do that.
Six times.
Never on this scale. Never. never been a dynamic model run at kilometer resolution. Even 50 kilometer resolution. Oh, Bruce thinks it can be done. You have to look at a small box embedded in the main flow and look at it, the box in high resolution, and just kind of let the...
You want to wait on this until they get the answer that you want?
No, I just want to know.
The answer is that they don't go away.
I don't see how you can...
...them is to fold it. If you can fold the stuff over several times, you can get maybe, you know, regions that have a lot of a particular thing in it. But if you don't do that, then you're just going to, you know, mix them...
Are there models with constant injection, like subduction?
There are. But when you want to treat a particular thing, like what happens to the particular package of subductive lithosphere, you can't do that by tracking it through, because you can't do the large-scale flow and do the fine-scale behavior of this thing at the same time. And so you have to use other arguments for what that's going to look like. And the bottom line is, and I think they've dealt with it well in this paper by Kellogg et al., is that it just gets skinnier, basically. You stretch it out, and as a function of time, it thins out.
I know that's the general direction it goes in. I want to know what it really looks like on a small scale that affects us when we sample it. I think we need to know that.
You know, on the way down.